Hello, and you're very welcome to episode 20 of The Fifth Court, a podcast on legal affairs presented by myself, Peter Leonard, barrister.
Myself, Mark Tottenham, barrister and editor of Decisis.ie.
20 shows, Mark, who would have thought?
Absolutely, 20 down and...
Well, hopefully another 20 to go and maybe 20 after that again. Well, last week, you will recall, we went outside our comfort zone slightly, but only... and this was beyond the bounds of the legal profession as we talked to consultant obstetrician Declan Keane and got a doctor's view on medical negligence and personal injuries litigation, and in particular we discussed the practice of what he termed expert shopping. Mark, that was a fascinating interview, wasn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. It's a subject close to my heart, as you know.
Yes.
And it was a very interesting discussion.
And it has gone down a bomb with our listeners. A lot of people with a lot of views talking to me during the week, I have to say. So we were very grateful to Declan for coming in. It was a really, really good interview. It was a fascinating interview. Well, this week we are slightly closer to home as we will be talking to the former chairman of the Labour Court, Kevin Duffy, whose contribution to the development of labour law in this jurisdiction has been simply quite immense. Kevin, who is a qualified barrister, and I believe a classmate of yours, Mark,
right.
Didn't realise that. Wow. In the King's Inns, presided over the Labour Court as chairman from 2003 until his retirement in 2016. And we're going to talk to him about his fascinating background in the trade union movement and the lessons he learned at the cutting edge of industrial relations and employment disputes over the years. But first, we're going to discuss three cases which you have identified from the Decisis website. And we start this week by looking at a number of cases concerning criminal compensation for victims of crime. The cases in question are Bowes and Brophy versus the Criminal Injuries Compensation Tribunal. They are decisions in the High Court of Mr. Justice David Holland. These are judicial review actions, Mark, and the applicants were challenging the decision by the tribunal to refuse them compensation on the basis that they had submitted claims outside the two-year limitation period.
Yeah, so this, as you say, they, basically a new criminal injuries compensation scheme was brought in 2021. And the two people in question had, without question, suffered very serious injuries as a result of criminal actions. One of them had been stabbed, and the other one had received blunt wound trauma to the brain in an assault. And they had both claimed, but the tribunal found that their claims were out of time. And basically, the issue seems to have been that the time limit had changed such that if they had brought their actions just before, the day before the new legislation came in or the new scheme came in, they would not have been statute barred. But because of the change in the legislation and the introduction of the new scheme, suddenly their actions became statute barred. And and Mr. Justice Holland basically said that this was not an injustice had arisen essentially
yes.
from that.
Okay, no, very good decision, I have to say. I think that's a very fair decision.
Yep.
They weren't beaten by the clock, which is a good thing. Well, next to a case concerning that thorny issue of security for costs, and these arise where effectively the party taking proceedings has to be able to assure the party being sued that they can cover that party's costs in the event that their claim is unsuccessful and that an award of costs is made against them. This is the case of Fanflex Limited versus Bandon Properties Limited, a decision in the High Court of Mr. Justice Brian O'Moore, and it concerns the termination of a joint venture company. The High Court granted an order that a plaintiff provide security for costs in the sum of €670,269.
Yeah, so
a lot of security for costs.
That's a very high order, and it did arise partly from the way that the application had been defended by the plaintiff. So, as you say, when obviously because companies of their nature have limited liability, when a company brings an action, if a defendant thinks that the company will not have sufficient money to cover their costs in the event of losing the case, they can bring an application for security, which essentially means that the company has to put money up, have the money in court, in order to cover the costs of the possibility of losing. Now, very often, and there was a kind of a rule of thumb that you would assess what the likely costs were going to be and that the courts would order security in maybe a third of that sum. But now increasingly they're kind of saying, well, why should the defendants only have security in relation to a third of the costs? And in this particular case, the defendant said, right, we don't believe that the company can provide can cover the costs. So there's a presumption that the security should be made. The company then failed. The company has the option of saying, well, one of the reasons that we can't provide the security of costs, we don't have the money, is because of the wrongdoing by the defendant. But the court didn't accept that. But they then went on to the court then looked at what the defendant's estimate of the costs was going to be. And in this case, as you say, the estimate came to $670,000 plus a bit.
Can I read the quote from Mr. Justice O'More that you have on your website, which is fascinating, I think. He says, I have assessed the likely costs of Bandon from the bringing of the motion for security at $670,269.34 on top of those euro. In reaching this figure, I have taken into account the fact that a bill of costs is unlikely to be measured in the full amount initially sought. So they were looking for more. And that view is supported by some of the fees described. For example, and this is the bit that caught my attention, Mark, I do not think that a refresher for senior counsel will be measured at €6,000 per day on a party and party basis.
Yeah, but I think what was interesting in this case is also that when the plaintiff, when the application had been heard, and he indicated that he wanted to award that, the plaintiff's counsel then looked to put in a further affidavit and make an application to that maybe the sum should be at a lower level, and Mr. Justice O'More basically said, well, you had one chance to defend this application and it's too late to put in any further affidavits.
To so use
very
the,
strict
the,
rule.
To use the phrase favoured by Frank Clark over the years, a high court action is not a dress rehearsal.
It's the first and final night of the show, I think. Yeah.
Okay, finally to a case of false imprisonment. This is the case of O'Farrell versus the governor of Port Leisha Prison, a decision of Mr. Justice Kean Ferreter. In this case, the judge awarded the sum of $2,500 in damages to two men who claimed they had been falsely imprisoned. However, while he did make a small award, the judge did not feel that their case merited substantial damages.
Yeah, so this is a question, an issue relating to two people who had been sentenced in England on what was described as terrorist offences. We won't go further into it, to the detail, but basically there was an arrangement between Britain and Ireland that whereby somebody who was serving a sentence in one country could apply to have the balance of the sentence served in the other country. And so that happened in this case, that the that they wanted to be returned to Ireland because they were from Ireland. And so they applied to be returned to Ireland. They were detained in Port Leisha from 2006 to 2014. But then it arose, and I think it arose in relation to a number of these cases, that the warrants upon which they had been detained in Ireland, having been returned, were in some way defective. And so they were released. And so they wanted to say, well, because we were imprisoned for 8 years on foot of defective warrants, we want to be compensated for our false imprisonment. And on the face of it, that doesn't seem unreasonable. To be detained in Portlaoise prison can't be pleasant for anybody, let alone for 8 years on a defective warrant. However, it's not unreasonable.
How do you put a value on 8 years of a man's life?
Well, this is it. But the but the issue that arose here was, of course, the fact that they themselves had applied to be returned from England to Ireland. So if they hadn't made the application, they would have been kept for longer because they were released before the termination of their sentence. And so therefore,
they
hadn't
the
actually suffered any loss in that regard.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Mark.
And so, I should just say that the damages were of a nominal basis. So it was $2,500 to each person.
Okay, very good. Back shortly with Kevin Duffy.
Silence in the Fifth Court.
Okay, it is my great pleasure to welcome to the studio retired chairman of the Labour Court, Kevin Duffy. Kevin, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us.
Well, delighted to have the opportunity, Peter.
And there's been an emotional reunion here. I didn't realise yourself and Mark are former classmates.
That's right.
Did the King's Inns together?
Yeah. It seems like a long time ago
There you go.
Did you ever practice?
No.
Which you were in the Labour Court at that stage?
I was
that roundabout then?
I had just gone into the Labour Court.
Yes.
I went into the Labour Court in 1997, and I started in the Inns in 99, I think.
So you were an assistant chair beforehand, were you, Kevin?
Deputy chair.
Okay, before you became chairman in 2003, is that right?
2003, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, okay, okay, all right.
Yeah, I was 6 years as deputy chair.
And presumably qualifying as a barrister and training as a barrister, that was very helpful to you in terms of your work.
It was indeed, particularly in light of the changes that were happening within the court, because I went into the court in 1997. And the only jurisdiction that the court had in respect of employment rights was under the 1994 Anti-Discrimination Equal Pay Act and the Employment Equality Act.
Yes.
Everything else was industrial relations, but it started to change around that time. I think the first additional piece of legal jurisdiction that the court got was under the Organisation of Working Time Act.
Yes.
Which was 1997. And all of the statutes that came on in the employment sphere after that came to the court.
And made a huge contribution to employment law and what you could do in your role as chairman of the Labour Court. Mm. We're going to talk a lot about your role as a chairman of the Labour Court and the huge contribution you've made to employment law in this jurisdiction. But can we go all the way back, Kevin? Let's go back to the start. Mm. You started out as a bricklayer, I believe.
That's right.
Will you tell us all about that?
Well, I started out, as you said, as an apprentice bricklayer. It was a very important trade and it was a 6 or 7 year apprenticeship required in order to
apprenticeship and a half, wasn't it?
Well, most apprenticeships were 6 or 7 years, which had nothing to do with the length of time that it took to learn a trade. It was to do with the length of time that you needed to progress from being effectively a child, because a lot of people started at 14 or 15 years of age, and you became an adult at 21, so the period in between was an apprenticeship. It really had nothing to do with the length of time. Apprenticeships have reduced significantly since then. But no, I followed, it was a long family tradition. My father was a bricklayer, my grandfather was a bricklayer. My father had five or six brothers, I can't remember which, all of whom were bricklayers.
Wow.
And I followed.
So there's large portions of Dublin City, or maybe beyond, that you can look at and say, we did that?
Lots of them have been pulled down since. And I don't think it had anything to do with the quality of the buildings. But yes, it's. I've often walked around the city and looked at gable ends and buildings and
okay.
Remembered.
So as well as
putting the bricks in place.
Absolutely. And as well as doing all that building work, you also became interested in the trade union movement.
Yeah, well, I became a trade union official in the old Building Workers Trade Union in 1973. I'd been involved with the union for a number of years before that, but I became an official in 1973. And I worked in the union for the following 15 years, and then I moved to the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, where I became an Assistant General Secretary.
So what trade union were you with initially? The building BATU, was it?
It's now BATU. BATU was an amalgamation of two unions. But I never actually worked in BATU. I was responsible for setting up the amalgamation, but before it happened, I left and went to work for Congress.
Okay. And what was that like? What was it like working for Congress?
Congress was
who was there at that stage? Peter Cassels?
Peter Cassels was the General Secretary. Peter had just come in as General Secretary. And it was decided at the time that they needed to beef up the industrial relations side of Congress. That was the time of social partnership and all of that. And I was employed and given responsibility for industrial relations, trade union organisation, and employment law, which was quite interesting because that was a time when there was quite a lot of employment legislation coming forward, mainly because of developments in Europe, the European Union. And I think it's very interesting because if you go back to when I started as a union official in 1973, there wasn't any employment legislation. There was the Redundancy Payments Act of 1967. There was a number of old Conditions of Employment Acts going back to the 1930s, which had applied mainly in respect to the distributive trade and shops and the like, but didn't have any broad application. And in 1973, there was the Minimum Notice in Terms of Employment Act, and that was it.
Yes.
So working as a trade union official in those days, that's all you had to know.
So
about.
What was it? Industrial relations disputes then, was
yeah,
that it?
Yeah, well, you see, at that time, and for quite a while afterwards, any rights that people had in employment or any obligations that employers had were derived from collective agreements, collective bargaining. And there was quite a high incidence of collective bargaining in Ireland at that time. It's gone way down now. But that was the main source of employment rights.
Okay. And when did the nod come then to sit on the Labour Court?
1997.
Okay.
1997.
And how does that happen, Kevin? Because we know there's a representative from the employers, generally an IBAC person.
Yeah, yeah.
And then obviously the trade union movement, and then you have a chairperson between the two.
Well,
of
in
them.
Those days, it's changed now, particularly under the Workplace Relations Act of 2015. But in those days, it was generally it was a ministerial appointment. But it was generally by consensus between Congress and what's now IBEC.
Yes.
Where you would simply
you'd be nominated, basically.
You'd simply be asked, were you, if you expressed an interest. And there would be discussions between the relevant department and Congress and IBEC, and out of that, somebody would emerge, and it happened to be me.
And who was the chair at the time? Finbar Flood?
Evelyn Owens.
Okay.
Evelyn Owens was the chair when I joined in 1997. Finbar became chair, I think, 2 years after that.
Okay.
And again, there was a practice where people would come from either an employer background or from a trade union background. Evelyn Owens' background would have been in the trade union movement, though she was primarily a politician before her appointment. Evelyn was a member of the Senate for many years, but she had come from the what was then the Local Government and Public Services Union.
Okay.
And she was the chair at that stage. And Finbar, who had been vice president of the FIE, which is the forerunner of IBEC, right, had been appointed as deputy chair some years previously, and it was generally expected that Finbar would succeed.
And is that the
Evelyn.
Way it goes?
That's the
so
way
the
it went there.
The trade union person steps out and the employer steps in again?
Generally, not all the time, but generally.
Okay, and there's kind of an element of fairness in that, I suppose, Kevin, isn't
Well,
there?
It maintains a balance, and
yes.
that was the idea behind it. And that's basically
okay. So
the way
you got into the chair
about.
In 2003, and you served for what, 30, into the maths, 13 years, was it?
Till 2016. So is it, it was 19 years in total. Yeah.
19 years, yeah, okay. Yes. But 13 years as the main man.
As chair.
As chair, right? We'll call it chair. Okay. Yeah. And just overall, before we get into it, I mean, was it an enjoyable experience, Kevin?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I was very lucky in many respects because Congress was extremely enjoyable. I loved Congress. It was challenging. I was involved in all sorts of activities that I found very satisfying. And the opportunity to go to the court came along. And it was a wonderful experience, particularly in light of the evolution of the court over that time. And there was very significant evolution, culminating, of course, in the 2015 Act, which effectively gave the Labour Court the status as the sole appellate tribunal in employment matters. And, you know, as I said, when I started in 1997, about 90% of the work was industrial relations. By the time I left,
it was all statutory entitlements.
It reversed. It was about 70-30 in favour of climate rights.
I'm interested in what you said, that when you started in the union movement, that people's rights derived largely from collective bargaining. So in those days, there was no Organisation of Working Time Act, there was no Unfair Dismissals Act, there was no Employment Equality Act. So the effect was that basically it was all contractual rights deriving from collective bargaining. So would it be fair to say that then, with the introduction of all this legislation, that the role of the union movement has been kind of reduced?
The role of the trade union movement has diminished significantly over time for a variety of reasons. I'm not sure that's necessarily at the forefront of it, but trade union density, not just in Ireland, but everywhere, has diminished significantly. Yeah. I don't know what it is. I mean, you hear various figures as to what the trade union density in Ireland now is. Some people would put it as low as 13% in the private sector. Yeah. It's much higher, of course, in the public sector for a whole variety of reasons. But in those days, trade union density was way up at 60% of the workforce. So it was, I suppose, to describe it as contractual, as obviously as lawyers, that's what the term we would use, but it was a collective agreement that people were expected to abide by.
But it also meant then that people who weren't in unionised industries had effectively no rights in terms of holiday.
There was a Holiday Employees Act going back to 1961, I should have mentioned that, and there was a Holiday Employees Act on 1973, but they were enforceable through the district court, not through the employment or the labour court or the employment tribunals. Because you had this problem with non-unionised employments or where collective bargaining didn't take place, you had provisions under the 1946 Industrial Relations Act, principally in relation to joint labour committees, which were intended to regulate areas that couldn't be regulated by collective agreements, because I think the whole thrust of the 1946 legislation was that the primary mode of determining pay and conditions of employment should be collective bargaining. It was very heavily directed towards facilitating and encouraging collective bargaining.
And were we following, I mean, just if that was 1940s legislation, were we basically adopting the sort of UK model at that stage, or did we have a different?
The labour relations system in Ireland obviously was derived from the British system.
Yeah.
You know, we inherited it. But and you did have things called trade boards, which operated in the UK and operated in Ireland going back to pre-independence days. But the labour court was a unique institution. There was no parallel, nor has there ever been a parallel in the UK. They have a body called ACAS, but that's a conciliation body. It's not an adjudicative body. So the Labour Court was a pretty novel initiative that was taken.
Brought
by
in
Sean
in the
1960s.
Right.
And it was primarily, came about because in the during the war, the emergencies, we had it. There were wage standstill orders, so people couldn't claim, and strikes were effectively prohibited.
Yeah.
All of that was coming to an end after the war. I think there was a concern that there could be very considerable industrial unrest, and the Labour Court and the various systems that were put in place around the Labour Court were intended to find another way of dealing with industrial disputes apart from industrial action. No, didn't mean that there wasn't industrial action. There was, but the Labour Court was unique in the sense that it was a body that was established to give a third view on the merits of a dispute.
Do you think, I mean, this has been really interesting, Kevin, and the history is fascinating. And obviously, as you say, traditionally representation for workers, for example, and employees that would have gone before the Labour Court was provided by their trade union. Now, that has all changed, really, over the years, hasn't it? As you say, you know, trade union membership has gone down.
Yeah.
And, you know, the trade union movement is not as prominent as it once was in Irish society. But do you think the Labour Court has moved with the times? Obviously, when you came in, there was the EAT in existence at the time. You had rights commissioners who were the first instance place, and then they would appeal their decisions to the Labour Court. Then we got the 2015 Workplace Relations Commission Act, which basically created the Workplace Relations Commission, and then the one appellate court, which is the Labour Court. But so that has been the evolution of the mechanisms for redress under the statutory provisions that are there for employees. But does the system work? I mean, if it's generally legal representatives now that attend the Labour Court, there's no costs because that was traditionally individuals would act for themselves or be represented by the trade union. This is a very, very long question, Kevin. Sorry about that. But where are we at the moment?
I'll give you a long answer.
Good. I mean, is the system that applies there still fit for purpose then?
Well, the system has evolved. I mean, as I was saying to you earlier on, it has moved from being an industrial relations body. If you look at the 1946 Act, the mandate for the Labour Court is to give its opinion on the merits of a dispute and on the basis upon which it should be resolved. So there were no rules other than common sense rules, you know, to try and find an accommodation between parties who were in dispute. And it was directed at looking at something that both sides could live with. So it wasn't based on rights. We often talk in industrial relations terms about disputes of interest, where you don't have a right to something, but you have an interest in getting it. And the Labour Court was primarily designed around resolving disputes of interest, right? Now, disputes of interest still arise, right? And it's the Labour Court has a very important function in dealing with them so as to avoid industrial conflict. But most disputes now arise from issues of right. And, of course, the court has evolved and it has had to evolve since it started being given jurisdiction for these type of disputes. And, you know, the culmination was in the 2015 Act. But before that, as I said, the court dealt with equality matters. Then the Organisational Work and Time Act. That was followed with the National Minimum Wage Act, where the court had jurisdiction, the Protection of Employees Fixed-Term Work Act and the Protection of Employees Part-Time Work Act. And they were all, you know, they were all assigned to the court. The court was the adjudicative body in those matters. And it had to change because, you know, if you were dealing with an industrial relations dispute, and the court, as everybody knows, acts by division, where you have three people, right? It wasn't a case where of simply saying, what's fair? It was a question of establish the facts,
yes.
Identify the legal principles, I suppose, and apply them.
So, of course, and I accept that. And you know, there is all this legislation which gives employees rights. But in order to pursue those rights, employees have to go before the Labour Court. And where traditionally they might have been represented by trade unions, and trade unions with great expertise and were able to help them, now they have to rely on legal representation. And they're generally up against employers. And this is a bugbear, I think, that exists amongst legal practitioners in this area.
Yeah.
They're up against employers who have the resources to employ legal teams and fight cases, whereas employees often don't. And it is the case that often awards are very small, very minimal. So somebody whose rights are vindicated, really, there's no vindication at all because they end up with very little, Kevin.
Well, they don't, particularly if they have to pay legal fees.
Yes.
But I think, certainly in my experience, there were some very good union officials appearing before the court in employment rights cases who knew the law, right? They wouldn't know any other aspect of the law, but they knew employment rights, and they were very good in that respect. Of course, there were people who appeared unrepresented. And the court, I think, has always had a tradition of trying as far as possible to assist unrepresented parties. Now, I used to often say to people, look, I can help you, I can't help you to make your case, but it can help you to present.
Yes, fair enough.
And the court will, as I think would adjudication officers, try as best they can to assist an unrepresented party in presenting the case. Because most of these cases, as I think we all know, turn on facts.
Yes.
Right? The legal principles are fairly clear. The real contest is around establishing the facts. No, people can be at a disadvantage in that respect. And in that context, there has been a debate for as long as I can remember about whether there should be a jurisdiction to award costs.
And where do you come down on that?
On balance against it. And
really?
I'll tell you
why.
Well, the main reason is that if there's a jurisdiction to award costs, costs can be awarded to you or against you. And I think it would deter a lot of workers, particularly on cases perhaps that aren't going to attract very high awards, right, from taking on the hazard of losing and having an award of costs made against them.
Yes.
And that's, you know, on balance, right?
Okay, I think that is a concern.
A lot of people in bringing cases. And that's why a lot of cases don't go beyond the statutory appeals mechanism into the courts. And particularly in the days when there was a de novo appeal into the circuit court in unfair dismissals cases, it was often used as a tactic by employers to run an appeal into the circuit court and invariably get a settlement. Perhaps at less than the case was worth, because the employee couldn't take on the risk.
Okay, so what about a potential solution to that then? Would be the American style system, where you don't have a cost scenario, but the award is of such magnitude that people can pay their costs. I mean, is that a solution? Is that the approach that we should take?
As you know, there's a limit on what you can do, and that's probably constitutionally necessary.
Yes,
that you have to. You, there's often cases where you'd love to be in a position to make a high award, but it is limited by statute. And I think the reason why it's limited by statute is to ensure that the court is exercising limited judicial functions. Now, all of this came out in Lewinsky, if I pronounce it properly.
The famous case.
The famous case.
It didn't change everything, but it was significant.
It was significant. Well, it was significant in that it changed procedures. But in what respect? It caused hearings at first instance to be in public.
And which is a good thing.
Which is a good thing. The reasons why I think the legislation was designed as it was, but it's now in public, that's clear. And evidence has to be given on oath, and that's clear also. But it put, I suppose, the argument that has been floating around for a long time, that all of this sort of specialist tribunals to deal with a whole branch of the law was going beyond what was constitutionally permissible. So it at least put that to bed.
Yes.
Yeah. Can I just bring you back to the comment you made about you distinguished between what you call disputes of interest and effectively disputes of rights or disputes of entitlement. Mm. And so if I understand rightly, what you're saying is that industrial relations disputes, you're basically talking about the various different interests and trying to come to a kind of third way or an objective. And then you've got your disputes of entitlement, where you've basically got to apply the law as closely as you can. And you've obviously sat over both types of dispute.
And
when you're... Does it take a different type of skill to determine one rather than another?
It does.
And
it does.
Do you think... are disputes of interest still happening to the same extent?
Oh, yeah.
And the same people are sitting over both.
Yeah. And it's the disputes of interest that most people hear about. Right?
Sure.
I mean, if you have, for example, a dispute in public transport, right, it potentially affects thousands of people, right, who are discommoded by the fact that the buses aren't running or trains aren't running or whatever, right? And there's always an imperative about trying to find a way of resolving those disputes and getting the buses back on the road or whatever, right? A dispute of right invariably affects one person. Yep. Very important to that person.
And how come
it affects one person?
How come in these disputes of interest, Kevin, they can only be resolved at 6 o'clock in the morning? Do you have to stay up all night?
Probably. Probably. It's a long tradition.
That is
a long tradition. No.
So we win a meet at 3 o'clock do, and we'll eventually do a deal in 15 hours' time.
Once the horse is still alive, you have to keep flogging it.
Can I just ask you, Kevin, just with your vast experience and genuinely, I mean, the contribution you made when you were chairing the Labour Court and since, and I know you've done loads of different things since, like public pay commissions and all those sort of things that you've chaired, but lacunae within employment law and statutory rights, is there any gaps that you found when you were presiding over cases that you felt weren't covered by the legislation that's out there?
Well, most issues that arise are covered now. The extent of the coverage is another matter, and there are some lacunae in some of the statutes, and obviously they have to be looked at from time to time. And some of them are highlighted from time to time in cases before the superior courts.
Yes.
And one that comes to mind is a case that it became well known as the Nano Nagle and Daly.
Yes.
Right? And one of the things that arose there was that there is, under the directive, an obligation to provide reasonable accommodation. Right? But
this is an employment equality case.
An employment
and
equality.
And this was a person with disability.
Yes. And the whole thing turned on the extent of an employer's obligation to provide reasonable accommodation. But what emerged was that while the Act prescribes that there should be reasonable accommodation, it's not a standalone cause of action. If it doesn't happen, for example, a failure to provide reasonable accommodation doesn't come within the definition of discrimination, such as, for example, harassment is deemed to be discrimination for the purpose of the 1998 Act as amended. But and that point was made by the Supreme Court. Perhaps a lot of people didn't latch on to it, but Mr. Justice McMenamin emphasised that point, that there wasn't a standalone right to reasonable accommodation. It's, if you like, a defence to a defence. So if the employer pleads that the person can't do the job, they can counterplead, well, I could if I was given reasonable accommodation.
Okay. Can I jump in with one further question before we, because this has been brilliant and we're unfortunately pushed for time, so we have to wrap it up, Kevin. Protected disclosures.
Yes.
That's been a whole new phenomenon and it was kind of coming in as you were going out the door. What do you make of that?
Well, it hadn't actually come in.
Okay.
Is it 2018? Is that Act?
2014, but it probably wasn't implemented.
It probably wasn't implemented. Yeah, right. I went in 2016. I didn't have a case under that. But I have
could
done,
have had a bit
though,
of fun with that.
Just for the benefit of our listeners who may not instinctively know what a protective disclosure is, this is the issue of whistleblowers, isn't it? So this is where somebody effectively says to somebody else, there is bad practice going on in my workplace and I think something should be done about it. And somebody who then gets fired for making that kind of disclosure. Isn't that the issue?
Well, two things about it. Firstly, it develops a concept that was already there called penalisation or victimisation, as it's described under some statutes. So the concept of penalisation or victimisation was well established under, and I dealt with umpteen cases, principally under the Safety, Health and Welfare at Work Act.
Yes.
A lot of penalisation cases. So the principle.
And that's the legal test that still applies.
It's the same legal test that applies. I have dealt with, in a private capacity since retirement, I've been asked to investigate some protected disclosures complaints.
Yes.
And look, in some instances, right, not all, it is a very important piece of legislation. And we've seen lots of examples of, you know, the benefit that can be derived by society generally from people who have the good conscience to disclose wrongdoing, right? And they should be protected. A lot of cases are taken where the disclosure couldn't reasonably be construed as having any public interest dimension. And of course, the courts have said that there doesn't really need to be a public interest element. I think that's been looked at in a revision of the legislation. But generally speaking, I think, you know, while there are difficulties, as there always are with new legislation, right, the principle that people who disclose wrongdoing should be protected, I think, is
a really good one.
Is okay. A good one.
Kevin, they are literally freaking out behind the window here, so I better wrap this up. And we can't let you go without the big question, Mark. What's the big question?
Big question, Kevin, for our listeners who are generally people in the legal profession or people who aspire to be members of the legal profession. Have you a book or film or other work of art you'd like to recommend to them?
I'm not a movie buff. I do read. And there are three books that I think are worth reading. One that I keep dipping into, right, is Joyce and the Law. I don't know if you've ever come across
it. Adrian
Hardiman. Okay.
Apart from it being extremely easy to read, right, it makes sense of, I mean, apart from being a lawyer of considerable repute and a jurist of considerable repute, Adrian Hardiman was also a Joycean scholar.
Yes.
Right? And he managed to make sense of Finnegan's Wake and Ulysses. Whatever about Ulysses, Finnegan's Wake seems to be beyond most people, certainly beyond me, to make sense of. But he makes sense of it and dips in and out of the various legal cases, obviously, in their time, that feature in either Ulysses. And it's very entertaining.
Very good. So did Joyce have a good handle on the law?
He did. Well, he dipped into various cases, criminal cases, cases in tort, and he mentions them as opposed to going into any analysis of them and seemed to understand what the issues were. But it's in such obscure language.
I seem to remember Adrian Hardiman gave life to the whole issue of poor Paddy Dignam's life insurance policy.
Absolutely.
Wasn't that the issue?
That's right, yeah. And that turned into a discussion on the law around insurance and contract, right? And that's one. There's another one which is that wouldn't generally be known, but it's a good read, particularly for those of us who've gone in and out of King's Inns. It's called A Night at the Inns by Henry Murphy, who's I think, a practicing
barrister. Esteemed barrister, and
a series of really short stories, fictional, but all around the dining at the inns and what happened before, and mainly what happened afterwards. It's worth reading. Another one which I got my hands on many years ago, and again, dip in and out of, very old one, but The Old Munster Circuit.
Oh, okay. Yes,
that's the Maurice Healy.
Maurice Healy, yeah. And that's actually very, again, well-written book, which is all about life at the bar 100-something years ago, right? And it's a very good, entertaining read. It also, I suppose, gives you a good indication of how the practice of the at law has changed, and more particularly the practice in the courts have changed.
Yes, of course.
Because some of the stories that he relates by today's standards sound as if they were slightly above kangaroo courts.
Well, Kevin, Mark asked you earlier, did you ever practice as a barrister? Mm. You know, that's still available to you. You could come on down, you know,
absolutely.
And give it a lash. There you go. Kevin Duffy, this has been fascinating. I have really enjoyed this interview. Thank you very much for coming in and being a guest on The Fifth Court.
The Fifth Court will adjourn until next week.
And that's all from this edition of the Fifth Court. We hope you have enjoyed it. Can we say a huge thank you to our guest, retired chairman of the Labour Court, Kevin Duffy, for coming in and talking to us about his fascinating career. And I would also like to say a huge thank you to our producer, Conal O'Moroyne, and to the Dublin South Podcast Studios and sound engineer Lee Brennan for recording this show and doing such a wonderful job. If you have any comments or any legal stories you'd like to raise with us, please contact us on our website or on LinkedIn. And Mark, we're asking people, as always, to share our show.
Absolutely. LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, or wherever you feel that members of the legal community are likely to hear about the show, or anybody else who might be interested.
Please tell them about it, you know. So from me, Peter Leonard.
And myself, Mark Tottenham.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon in the Fifth Court.